You are listening to The Link, an interactive podcast hosted by public policy experts at the U.S. Oncology Network. Your link to the policy that matters most.
Good morning and welcome to sunny Orlando, Florida. We are live here at the Community Oncology Alliance annual meeting. This is the Link podcast, linking physicians to policy. Again, my name is JC Cardenas, and this morning I'm joined by a great panel, Angela and Dr. Pat.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is the first opening day of COA's annual conference. We're all excited to be here. Tons of energy in the room. Dr. Pat, you want to give us a little introduction into your role with COA and, you know, how everything sort of shaped out?
Sure. I'm Dr. Deborah Pat. I serve as the Vice President of the Community Oncology Alliance and a medical director of public policy for the U.S. Oncology Network. I practice in Texas oncology, and I do a lot of public policy work, which is why I think it's so important to engage with the Community Oncology Alliance. And I'm excited about this meeting and all of the work that we're doing together, because I think it ensures the future of community oncology, which is so important for the healthcare of Americans.
Yeah. And I think that's really important too, just the role that you guys play in everything. And Angela, you want to talk a little bit more about some of the work you've been doing with Dr. Pat and how everything sort of played into the conference this year?
Yeah. And I know Dr. Pat and I have been on the podcast a lot together. We are always in the trenches in Austin. But Angela Storseth, Senior Director of Government Relations. If you listen in to our podcast, you guys know I'm over our state team. We have Allison Rollins on the West Coast, and we have on the East Coast, and then we have Ryan Soul on the West Coast. And so Dr. Pat and I work very closely together on a lot of times policies will evolve in Texas while other things start in other states. But a lot of it's talking about what are the trends? What are we seeing across the states? What can we bring to these other states if we're passing something in Texas? And I'd say our biggest thing that we're working on right now, when we were able to get our prohibiting white bagging mandate bill passed in Texas, we're now working hard to, it passed in Oregon. It is on its way to pass in Colorado. We're working on initiatives in Maryland and Ohio. And so I'd say that's kind of where we really work together, is sitting down, strategizing, thinking through what does community oncology need and how can we be effective on the state landscape?
Yeah. So I would say our partnership in the practices in the U.S. Oncology Network has been really critical. It's supporting many of these policy initiatives, public policy initiatives, as they support care delivery. So, you know, we see them on the federal level all the time with things like physician reimbursement, challenges in site of service parity, issues with regarding consolidation, the ability to deliver oral drugs to the patients we serve. And we fight those battles federally, and grateful to have a partner always at the table, because I think we're making a tremendous amount of progress. Angela and I have worked together a lot on state policy issues around prohibition of white bagging mandates, trying to prevent things like steerage of oral oncolytic dispensation to allow patients to get cared for by their doctors, which has been really important for the care of patients in community oncology. And I think really allows community oncologists to be empowered at their site of service and to give them the best opportunity to meet the challenges that they face before them. I'm really excited, though, at this meeting, we're talking about, I'm on a panel in just a little bit talking about sort of the future of oncology. And while you are our partners in always sort of thinking about how we remove barriers and create solutions to make community oncology more efficient and effective, we face a new set of challenges with workforce. And some of that is that, you know, the American Medical Association estimates that 1 out of 5 doctors and 2 out of 5 nurses will leave oncology in the next 5 years. We are at a critical staffing shortage. There is a projected growth in the oncology space, yet there is a decrease in the supply of oncologists that are available. And so
Do you mind talking about why is that projection of them leaving oncology?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of reasons. I think that as, you know, it's been harder to be a doctor. There are a lot of things that make burnout more substantial. As I talk to many doctors who are incredibly grateful for the work that they do to serve patients, that's incredibly meaningful. Things like administrative burden, dictations, managing insurance companies, escalating demand with prior authorization, denials of appropriate services. Those are all things that so palpably contribute to burnout for physicians that many doctors are choosing to leave the workforce, and nurses are choosing to leave the workforce, not because the work isn't gratifying or even that they're unwilling to meet the challenges of a increasing patient population, but rather those barriers and those administrative burdens take such a toll on them that burnout necessitates them to leave practice. And so we see people even prematurely leaving practice because of these burnout issues are so challenging. So I think it comes back to how do we work smarter and not harder? You know, how do we support our oncologists and our staff in the clinics in care delivery to make sure they can do what they need to do to care for patients, be efficient and effective, but also to have appropriate work-life balance? So I'll talk about this today at the COA meeting on my panel of the future of oncology leaders. And I'll actually return to Texas on Saturday where I'll talk to my partners about this. I like to call them the Home for Dinner initiatives. And they're things that our practice is doing and that the network is doing to support doctors and our staff to work better, to make sure that we're more efficient and effective. They're everything from doing pilots in scribe services, an AI scribe service to try to decrease the dictation burden, to using large language models and artificial intelligence to do things like easily create information back to payers whenever we get denials for prior authorization, to video tools to engage patients in their care journey, informing them about cystoscopy or colonoscopy or the chemotherapy that they're about to receive, and a lot of investments in leadership development for doctors and their administrative partners that we think of as sort of the dyad of leadership across the practices. I think these are incredibly important initiatives. The other things that we're doing are investing in our advanced practice providers and thinking about how we grow those services to try to meet the increasing need. So, Angela, back to your question, it's not only that the workforce has new challenges and escalating challenges of administrative burden, but also there's an increasing population of cancer patients. We have the good fortune of the age distribution of the population changing, and we're living longer. So those cardiologists are doing a great job managing hypercholesterolemia, and people are dying less frequently of heart attacks or not as quite as young of heart attacks. So cancer is something that's growing, and we can see that the cancer growth is anticipated. So even though we're better at diagnosing cancer early, we're better at screening, we're better at preventing, and we're certainly better at curing and treating cancer, because of the age distribution changes, we still anticipate that more cancer patients will emerge and that they will be on therapy for a longer period of time. So we have to plan appropriately for the oncology workforce to meet the needs of the growing population.
And Tracy, I was going to ask you a question, something on what Dr. Pat mentioned when we were talking about things that we might start seeing around AI. There's been a lot of policy conversation, I know, on some states when we're talking about how our health insurance company is going to use AI to, as you said, Dr. Pat, quicker denials. Are you guys seeing anything on the federal landscape? And what can we foresee, I guess, for next year?
Yeah. Ultimately, I think, there's a lot of discussion right now around AI. And I think ultimately in Capitol Hill, there's been a lot of discussion revolving around a lot of laboratory testing, diagnostics as well related to cancer. And I think there was a committee hearing last week or 2 weeks ago related to a lot of the AI and some laboratory testing. There's been a new request for information from some of the federal agencies around this. So I think this is a really hot topic. I don't know exactly, how in-depth Congress will get this year, but I know right now they're pretty much in the information receiving time where they want to hear from stakeholders like us, making sure that they're hearing from the physicians, from our stakeholders, just trying to share our understanding, because I think there's a lot of different nuances within the AI world, especially when it comes to cancer diagnostics. And I think there's a lot of good change that's coming, but I think we also need to, work together to make sure we're not preemptively going into it too fast to make sure we don't get, you know, those false negatives or anything like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of it's a very dynamic time for artificial intelligence. You know, you have to be living under a rock to not see it because it's top of fold in the New York Times every day. I had the good fortune of hearing Mickey Tripathi from the Office of the National Coordinator talk about emerging policy in organizations of jurisdiction over AI at the federal level. And I was really excited to hear that it seems like there's a coordinated effort to try to make sure as new issues evolve that the governing bodies are communicating around the policy to make sure that there's parsimony in the federal policy that emerges. A challenge that I think we're going to see from the states, though, is that many states are also instituting policies around AI. And as this is going to be a very useful tool in healthcare, with real limitations, I mean, there are issues even in sort of generative AI, the large language models with things like hallucinations and data fabrication and data leakage that pose real challenges that need to be understood and mitigated. There's tremendous opportunity, right? We have so much work to do in the patients that we serve, and AI is going to help us predict risk. It's going to help us inform patients to improve the patient journey by educating patients, reducing the asymmetry of information between doctors and patients. It's going to help us in clinical decision support with helping to nudge the right therapy that ultimately, at the end of the day, is a decision between doctors and patients. But these are helpful tools, kind of like I drive my car, but I really like Google Maps help in getting me to my destination. You know, this is
especially
gonna
for
be,
those traffic updates.
Exactly. This is going to be a really important way that healthcare and cancer care evolves. So, Angela, I think we're going to have our challenges in the states. Because I do have the concern, as sometimes happens in healthcare, when state policy is divergent from federal policy, you know, that gets complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. And with the kind of changing landscape in AI, hopefully some of that will help with some of the burnout.
Yeah. And we to ease some of the workload and take off some of the unnecessary burden.
I'm grateful that US Oncology have been early adopters in some of these technology changes, because I feel like the early adoption of some of these changes has really gives us an opportunity to, you know, work smarter, not harder, in the way that we care for patients, and to really diminish some of those administrative burdens. Everything from making the electronic health record easier, to using digital scribes, to using videos to inform patients, to using a chat GPT tool for US Oncology, or a large language model to try to do some of the work streams that we otherwise took too much mind power and too much time from our day. Or as I would like to say, they prevent us from being home for dinner.
Right.
And so by giving us these tools and giving doctors and staff these tools, it allows us to spend less time doing the things that we don't like to do in the office. We get to get home for dinner, whether that's, you know, helping our kids with their homework or tending to our parents or jogging with our friends or whatever it is that provides you balance in life. It's really important not to lose sight of that. And that's how we maintain a stable workforce and make US Oncology the best place to work in healthcare.
Yeah, awesome. And so just as we wrap up, one closing thought on that, I think, you know, just as AI continues to develop, I think, especially the way the public policy and the federal policy sort of the way it sort of works, there's just so much innovation happening so fast. I think there's a little bit of a lag between the policy regulatory implementation. So as you guys can hear, there's a lot of people. This is the first networking session here at COA. So a lot of people have come to the booth to sort of talk and meet. And so we're looking forward to connecting with a lot of our other peers. Dr. Pat, anything else you're looking forward to at this conference as we wrap up this podcast?
I will just say I've supported public policy for the US Oncology Network for many years, and the team has grown tremendously as the states have become such a battleground and the federal issues have gone from intermittent with a certain cadence to drinking from a fire hose.
Yeah.
I'm really grateful to have good partners as we embark upon this journey together.
Yeah,
we're grateful to have you.
Yeah, you're a rock star, and you're able to join us and help us whenever we can. And we're so thankful for all the work you do. And so we're looking forward to your panel coming up here. What is it, a little bit less than an hour?
Yes.
So Thank you again for joining us on The Link. We'll see you later this afternoon. And again, everyone, thank you so much for joining us, to Angela and Dr. Pat. We'll connect with you all shortly later. Stay tuned for more coming from COA.
Thank you.
You are listening to The Link, an interactive podcast hosted by public policy experts at the U.S. Oncology Network. Your link to the policy that matters most.
Good morning once again, everybody. This is The Link, linking physicians to policy. We are live once again here from the Community Oncology Alliance annual meeting here in sunny Orlando, Florida. Again, my name is JC Cardenas, and I'm the Associate Director for Federal Government Relations based in Washington, D.C. And right now I'm actually joined by Ryan Solt from our state team and Puneeth from our payer team. Ryan, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, certainly. Ryan Solt, Senior Manager of Government Relations for the U.S. Oncology Network, and I support practices in the western part of the country, so pretty much all of our practices west of Illinois.
Yeah, and I'm excited to be joined right now by Puneeth, one of the great members from the payer team.
Hello, everyone. I'm Puneeth Inderlal, Senior Director for Care Transformation and Analytics with the Impact Analytics team supporting the U.S. Oncology Network.
Yeah, so thank you so much, Puneeth, for joining us today. I know a lot of the work you guys have been doing with Dr. Will Fong and everything that supports practices is really, really huge to, one, a lot of the work we do in the policy space, especially in the value-based care space. You want to talk a little bit more about some of the work you've been doing and some of the trends you've been noticing from the work you've been doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think value-based care has evolved a lot over the last several years, and value-based care has turned into much more than just a buzzword today. Within oncology, the value-based care space is booming and expanding every single day. We do have a couple of pioneer programs within the network. The Enhancing Oncology Model, which is a program by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, is one of the key programs that we support throughout the practices. We have 12 of the practices in the network participating in the model. Despite being just 12 practices, we represent almost 50% of the model. And our early experience within the program has been quite favorable. Majority of our practices are continuing to bend the cost curve. They're innovating on delivering quality care. They're making sure that we are addressing the health equity concerns. They're making sure that we are venturing into the risk-bearing space with confidence and setting the stage for us to be continually leading the value-based care landscape in oncology.
Yeah, and just to put that into perspective, especially for the listeners, an enhancing oncology model is the new iteration of the former oncology care model, which ran from, was that 2016 to 2021? Is that correct?
2016 to 2022, actually.
2022. And so the network as a whole, the participation, they saved over $350 million to Medicare. Is that correct?
Its specific numbers were about $333 million to Medicare over the course of the 6 years. Large part of that was also driven through care transformation. We were successful with driving down unnecessary hospitalizations by about 38%, reducing unnecessary ED visits by about 18%, improving the end-of-life care for our patients with hospice enrollments in a timely fashion by about 6%. But there's work remains to be done, and we are continuing to innovate in these spaces to drive better quality of care.
Yeah, and I know that that's a big investment that I think the network and a lot of our practices have really made to make sure that, you know, patients get that, you know, that extra bit of care, and also that physicians are, you know, helping out with the reimbursement structures. Can you talk a little bit about some of the changes within that model and you know, some of the risk associated from the previous version to now the new enhancing oncology model?
Yeah. With the prior model, practices had the opportunity to participate in the model without taking on any downside risk, but they had the opportunity to earn some incentives. Were they able to bend the cost curve sufficiently? This model is a little different, wherein right from the beginning, you are subjected to two-sided risk, meaning if you didn't save Medicare money, there is a probability that you may have to pay Medicare money back in the program. It's a way of incentivizing practices to take the accountability for the total cost of care and try to bend the cost curve, then move in the fee-for-service space as we have for the last several decades. What it also hopes for is that there is no compromise in the quality of care, and there is continual improvement in the quality of care by way of putting in care transformation requirements. The OCM had several such requirements as well, and it set the stage for a lot of our practices to implement new strategies for delivering care that would be cutting edge, that would be differentiating for these patients, bringing in social work, bringing in dietitians, nutritional services, bringing in navigators, care navigators who can help them navigate through their symptom toxicity or making sure that these patients can be supported throughout the journey of their cancer care. These pivotal changes happened as a prelude to the EOM. With the EOM now, these practices that succeeded are venturing into the new era. They're venturing into new spaces with driving health equity changes, with making sure that patients' disparities of care are being addressed so they can receive effective treatment for their cancer illness.
Yeah.
So that's a new pivotal change.
Yeah, and I think it's all amazing work. And I know the support that your team does and some of the analytics that you guys do really puts that into perspective with some of the savings and the cost associated with a lot of that. And so I know we're still 1 year pretty much into this iteration, but what do you sort of forecast for practices as we, you know, continue into this year and going forward? Because I know we're about to hit one of the first benchmarks. Is that right? For the model?
So we are about 9 months into this program right now, and we're going in strong. We're going in with enough data and backing to make sure that we are going to be successful. To begin with, I can say that data is now the biggest asset that you can have in not just performing within these models, but also just surviving as a practice in today's ecosystem. And what we've been able to do is to support our practices with enough insights and guidance to set their strategy and operationalize that strategy on a day-to-day basis so you can be successful. Particularly when it comes to what we see within the data, we are pretty reassured that we are finding all of the areas where we can make a difference and execute on this appropriate strategies, be it pharmaceutical strategies where you're picking the appropriate drugs for the appropriate patient for the appropriate illness, or it's non-therapeutic strategies where you're finding ways to better the patient experience so they can have better outcomes, they can have better quality of life, they can have better response to these treatments that they're receiving. And we are getting the most for the dollar that is being invested in the care of these patients.
Mm-hmm. And so I think it's definitely the work that you guys do is you know, one, it supports the practices and helps them understand, you know, the investment that they're going to have to put and some of the resources they're going to have to invest into the program. But one of the fun things we actually did was you guys and your team were actually in Washington, D.C. not too long ago with Lisa Langenderfer and I myself. And we actually had the opportunity to take you guys to Capitol Hill and meet with some congressional offices to talk a little bit about your work and value-based care of the network. What was that experience like for you?
You know what? Right out the door, it was the most rewarding experience, I would say. We had never had the exposure to what happens at the Hill. We obviously know that it takes a village, and that village is not just within the network or within our practices. It is even outside, which is within the community leaders, who represent us at Washington. And the experience of having to go out there, meet these incredible folks who are involved in setting the policy that will drive change within this ecosystem was really rewarding. Particularly having to meet with all the young folks who are brains behind the scenes.
Yeah.
That was an incredible surprise for me. And they are very thoughtful. They are asking you very great questions that help understand the space, because they may not have the necessary background of the space itself.
Yep.
And we are here as a network that is advocating for the benefit of the practices and the patients that we serve. And they recognize that. They ask questions to understand better what our motivations are, what our approach is, and how can they better support our approach in making care accessible for our patients.
Mm-hmm. What
that was incredible.
What surprised you most? Because I know a lot of people go into Capitol Hill thinking, like, you know, because they see it on TV and all these people that grandstand on, you know, committee hearings and stuff. But then, like you said, they don't really realize that half the work, majority of the work, is done by the people behind the scenes.
Staff.
You know, staffers that you met with. And
usually in their 20s. Yeah.
So what kind of surprised you most coming out of that experience?
I think that very aspect of staffers in their 20s was a significant surprise. But I think despite them being in their 20s, their curiosity, mm-hmm. their inquisitiveness, their ability to grasp at what we are speaking about and ask meaningful questions in response to what we were speaking with them about, that was really surprising for me. Like, I'd say I wasn't like that in my 20s. But I'm glad that these folks are at the top of their game and they are looking out for their constituents. They're looking out for all of us. They're looking out for the oncology community as well as patients and the community at large.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really good because a lot of the work that Lisa and I do going to Capitol Hill, you know, we talk about the value-based care models and all the resources that the network provides to patients within their districts and their constituents. So I think being able to have you guys sort of in front of them sharing, you know, some of that story and that perspective that you guys do and the work, sort of the numbers behind everything, I think really helped, especially with some of the offices that, you know, we're close to, being able to take you guys to those staffers and just sort of reinforce the value of the network and some of the needs for these policy changes that we've been working on. So just sort of as we wrap up this segment, we're here at COA, as everybody can hear in the background, but what are you looking forward to as we begin this day and then go into tomorrow?
Yeah, COA has been one of those rewarding experiences as well when we look at bringing the oncology community together. The theme of stronger together really resonates with us. We as a network have always had that motto of come together to be stronger. And this is enhancing that with bringing everyone within the oncology community together. So that is really awesome.
Yeah.
When it comes to the agenda, I think the topics are really excellent. There are topics ranging from everything on the clinical side, all the way to the business of running an oncology practice or surviving the new age. We mm-hmm. have topics on AI. I know that's a pretty hot topic now, and everyone is excited and scared at the same time about the prospects of what AI can bring to the table. So those are a couple of sessions that I'm looking forward to, particularly looking at how AI can transform oncology care. We've had our own little experiences with machine learning models, and we've learned a lot in the process, and we know it is currently not in a place where it can replace clinical decision making.
But it can be a helpful resource.
It can be an augmenting resource, yes. Mm-hmm. And we're looking forward to some of that. Aside from that, the policy space is ever changing. And obviously, we thank all of you for keeping us up to speed on these different aspects and looking to learn more about how we can come together and support each other through all of the changes that happen in this regulatory space and becoming better at value-based care and being champions of value-based care. Last but not least, it was called out at this morning's discussions as well. The Change Healthcare outage has been a pretty significant...
Yeah. It's been a big hindrance on a lot of productivity and a lot of work and ultimately delay in care for a lot of patients.
Exactly. You took the words right out of my mouth. I think it's been a big hindrance, and we obviously really value all the support that the network teams are bringing to the practices, but also what COA is doing in terms of advocacy along with all of you in partnership. So that's been another area of focus for us as well.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Puneeth. Thank you for joining us. We'll hopefully be able to catch up throughout the conference. And please stay tuned as we continue to bring you more podcasts from live from COA. And we continue bringing some great speakers coming through that are going to be presenting throughout the conference. So again, for Ryan, Puneeth, and JC, this is The Link. And please join us as we continue to do more from COA.
Thank you.
You are listening to The Link, an interactive podcast hosted by public policy experts at the U.S. Oncology Network, your link to the policy that matters most.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to the Link podcast, linking physicians to policy. We are once again here in sunny Orlando, Florida, at the Community Oncology Alliance on site at the Hilton Orlando. Again, my name is JC Cardenas, and I am the Associate Director for Federal Government Relations based in Washington, D.C., and excited to be here in Orlando. And right now, today, I'm joined by Ryan Solt and a special guest, Glenn Belaski from Colorado. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. Thanks for having us here today.
Yeah, we're excited to be here. There's a lot of energy in the room. I mean, as you can hear in the background, we're in one of the networking sessions in between many of the great sessions that have already happened this morning. We're in day one of COA. So, Glenn, I know you're having a panel tomorrow. Want to talk a little bit more about what that's going to look like and what to look forward to at the conference?
Sure. So once again, I'm Glenn Belaski. I'm the executive director at Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers based in Colorado. Our panel that I'm participating on tomorrow is maybe not the most glamorous subject, but probably a very important subject in these days and times, doing a refresh on revenue cycle and what's very important in revenue cycle. With the recent Change Healthcare outage, the clearinghouse hiatus that occurred, getting revenue cycles back in shape is going to be job number one for all practices in the next 6 months. And so we didn't know that was going to happen, obviously, when we planned this presentation, but we're really trying to focus on highlighting a more proactive approach in revenue cycle, making sure that authorizations are done, that the teams are informed, talking about a couple of us just sharing our success stories, and how do you keep that area active, vibrant, and well-functioning, because it's incredibly critical for the overall success of the practice.
Yeah, and I know you mentioned the Change Healthcare impact, and how has RMCC impacted, and how has the network been able to sort of mitigate some of the issues with that, what is the outlook on that looking
like?
Yeah,
so, from the day of the outage, February 21st, to really pretty much the end of March, we're in a 2-3 phase kind of recovery mode. One, we had a problem that we'd never seen before. We're hoping it would go away in a day or two. It didn't. So we had to start to really elevate our game of doing some things manually. Then the network supported us with efforts to pivot to our EHR, use its capabilities for scheduling and registering patients. So we had a more solid workaround to get us through the coming weeks. Then when the system got restored from a practice operations perspective, we had to pivot back, and that was a transition back. Some of the work we had done in the EHR now had to be redone in the scheduling system to get things ready, to get things prepared. But we really focused on getting everything right, having good quality information. We're probably still following up on appointments where we told the patient, hey, you don't have to come back for 6 months. We'll call you when we have a chance. We deferred some of the work that we didn't have to do, but we've brought our rhythm and flow, and our clinics is brought back up to normal. But then a real key phase, and that's why it ties into talking about revenue cycle at the conference tomorrow, is what are we doing to assure that our revenue cycle gets back online? Because it really got put on hiatus for almost 30 plus days.
Yeah.
And so we didn't have charges going out. We didn't have payments coming in. So all that work,
that
the revenue
backlog.
Cycle team has been catching up. They were able to come real close to getting all of our charges booked for the month of March. And the rest will get out this coming week. So that's a win. That's just an incremental process to get better. But we've also supported them. I've supported them by asking them to assure quality. Don't do things fast to give us problems later. We're focused on quality. Our charges are as pristine as they always would be. So when this payment recovery starts, it'll be less of a dramatic effect. But there will be a lot of noise in that payment recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And my biggest fear, one of our revenue cycle leads shared two words that scared me last week. The two words were workforce shortage associated with the payers. So their ability to physically recover is just, it's a big question mark.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a month of backlog, but we've already known that they've been in kind of tight issues with their workforce. And now they got volumes and volumes of claims, And the computers can do so much, but when the computers kick something out, it takes people to put them back in and keep them moving. And so I have legitimate concerns, and we'll just have to watch their performance.
Yeah,
see how that all recovers.
That human touch and having to sort of put everything together one-on-one on the personal side, that's not really electronic anymore, and it's been tough.
And Glenn, are you finding that the patients kind of understand what happened with Change, or is it because it's not been very, you know, super publicized in the news for how big of a deal it is?
But I'd say it's been mixed in layers. Some patients are very perceptive, linking news events and asking questions. We were guarded because we didn't know what to say in the first week or so. In an event like this, we have subsequently published on our website and had handouts in our clinics to say, hey, we've been affected by this. Sorry for the inconvenience. We're working through it. But we are going to have a phase ahead here where now patients are going to get an EOB where they normally would have gotten it 2-3 weeks after their initial visit. Now they're going to get one that's 2 months, and they're going to say, hey, what's wrong? And now then their patient balances are going to be popping up. So we've lost rhythm, and some patients, you know, just like our patients expect rhythm in how we care for them, they expect rhythm in how we service them when it comes to the bills.
Yeah. And I think it really, the patients see it most in the scheduling and everything like that and the upfront.
Yeah, I think we got through that for the most part, but I think it'll just be this echo with the EOBs and then we're going to put our patient financial counselors under a little more stress because they're going to have to dealing with these questions with the patients and then we're going to be anxious to take care of that part of our relationship with the patients because we're now backed up.
Yeah.
So it's complicated.
And so pivoting a little bit to a little bit of a different topic, we're here at COA, here at the conference, always greatly attended, tons of great colleagues, but you're now on the board for COA.
I am.
And experience been like?
Well, it's my second year actually being on the board. I was around when COA was formed 20 some years ago. I got into practice administration literally 3 months after COA was formed and saw it. So I've seen it grow up. I've seen it grow from maybe a small conference at a small hotel in Phoenix, Arizona to now, you know, this, you know, 2,000-3,000 type attendee model where back then it was 150 people at best. But COA has grown so much. COA is the recognized name when it comes to oncology, if not major medical issues on the Hill. And that's a measure of the success of, you know, the engagement that COA's had on the Hill, the persistence that they've had, learning lessons that you don't always walk up to the Hill and ask for something and expect to get it. You earn the right. You build the relationships, you build the rapport.
Yep.
If a legislative aide leads from an office that you had a relationship with, then great, we got to build a new relationship.
Yep.
So this kind of persistence in a good, steady way has given COA a voice. So our board meetings are focused on what are COA's priorities, and it's COA is funded by conferences like this, the support of sponsors like McKesson and other companies. But then our legislative agenda is to drive the things that help oncology, whether it's payment parity, a fix to the doctor pay mechanisms. We've got challenges to a stark issue related to shipping prescriptions to patients' home.
Oh, yeah.
So we're staying persistent on those fronts. And then there are big issues that have been there a long time but continue to perk along, like 340B, things that create disparity in the medical system. That's what COA has been trying to amplify.
Yeah.
And so we have to support the organization to what are our priorities, what are we driving for that benefits all of community oncology.
No, yeah, I think that's great. And I know COA is a good partner, and we, you know, we work on a lot of the very similar issues.
Yes.
And we appreciate you and all your work and everything that Dr. Busby and everybody at the RMCC practice has done to help us with our public policy initiatives, especially with the home delivery issue, as you mentioned.
Right.
And being able to help put that into perspective for a lot of members.
Yeah, and Glenn, so we'll pivot a little bit to what's happening in Colorado. Now, you and the RMCC physicians are have been super engaged in the Colorado legislature and the legislative process for a really long time now. And in the past couple of years, y'all have been leading an effort on prohibiting white bagging mandates by payers in the state. And we've actually now gotten some traction on that bill. This legislative session. Do you want to talk a little bit about your experience in that in this whole couple year process and kind of how we've gotten to this point?
So just like in Washington, you have to have patience. The beauty of the state government world is things move a little quicker and there's more direct contact, a lot more intimacy. So we tried to gain sponsorship to bring forward an anti-white bagging bill last year. And for our listeners, anti-white bagging is our goal is to not allow a payer to impose anti-white bagging on a practice. If they so choose to do it, that's okay. But and the idea of white bagging is that the prescription drugs for the patient would be shipped to our clinic to give to the patient, and we have numerous concerns about the delays that it would cause, the operational haywire that it would cause, that the challenges it would cause in delivering what we can do day in and day out in a much better way, much more efficient fashion. So the legislative process is just like anything. You've got to gain understanding. So we met with many different representatives, but coming into this calendar or this legislative session, we're able to find two representatives that we had started this with last year. Got cut off in the process last year, but they stuck with us. We've worked with them, educated them. They've become very articulate. So because they're professionals, they don't want to go to their colleagues in committees or on the floor of a state house or senate and say, well, just please vote for this. No, they got to embrace it and understand it. So all of us have helped with frequent conference calls, reviewing the issues, answering their questions, helping them answer challenging questions that they've gotten from other representatives, brokered compromises. We've been in meetings, Ryan, you've been in part of those meetings where another representative says, well, I'd really like you to add this or change that. We say, how about this? And voila, maybe in a world that is still polarized in many different regards, we've actually had success in brokering compromise.
Yeah, and this bill recently just overwhelmingly passed the House of Representatives and is now waiting further consideration in the Senate. And it's received, you know, like you said, overwhelming bipartisan support. Yeah. And looking forward to continuing that process going into the spring.
And we worked with the governor's office to make sure they were understanding. So we've all, but I hopefully assured that they won't come up with a last minute veto, that they're appreciative of what we're doing, why we're doing. So it takes engagement, takes effort, takes time. And you can't always control the in fact, you cannot control the process. You got to ride it along, take it day by day, month by month. But encourage others that, it's not difficult, but you have to be patient.
And I think you hit that right on the head with the, you know, it takes patience and, you know, that relationship building. And then whenever you guys can, you know, continue that engagement with the practice, and then if you can have multiple practices coming in, you know, within the state or especially at the federal level, being able to get that. I know when we have you guys and multiple other practices come in and do meetings, it really does do that like extra touch point. Mm-hmm. And not only building the relationships, but also, you know, just adding another layer to the foundation.
Yeah.
Because we may be talking about one issue, but something else may come up, like the Change Healthcare that nobody was expecting. And, you know, now being able to go back to these offices, what we've already been talking to, and they have that relationship and that understanding, I think really does play a pivotal role in that.
Yeah, you're very much right there, JC. And that base, establishing that base to work from that position. And these are good people out there, especially at the state level, even the federal level. They're very dedicated people. They're just part of complicated environments, political dynamics that we may not fully understand. So we have to listen and learn their side of the story as well.
Yep. And so as we wrap up, any closing thoughts, or what is the one thing you've either, you know, enjoyed already seeing from day one, or what are you looking forward to aside from your panel tomorrow that you're looking forward to in the at the conference?
Well, the good thing about a conference like this is everybody should walk home with a dozen or more new ideas. Yeah. because I've always said this, every oncology practice is probably best in class in one thing, but is maybe a laggard in another mm-hmm. thing. There is no practice that's figured out everything. So a meeting like this is to prompt us, to challenge us, to remind us that, hey, others have done this, we can do it. Others have faced same challenges. Just got out of the cybersecurity discussion. It was very timely, and would love to give a medal to the practice administrator that had to deal with his practice being literally ransomware over the Christmas holidays a couple years ago.
That's so scary, yeah.
And yet he got through it, and he was here to share the story.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Glenn. We really appreciate you taking the time. I know it's a busy conference, but I really appreciate you coming by and sharing your panel and what we can look forward to. And thank you again so much for all your help with helping our public policy team and helping Ryan and myself up in DC. So really appreciate everything you guys do and all the hard work you guys do. So thank you again for stopping by. Again, this is the Link Podcast. Stay tuned. We're here on site at COA. We have many more great panelists who will be speaking at the conference, joining us for a couple podcasts later this afternoon and tomorrow. So looking forward to bringing those to you. So thank you all again.
Thank you for listening to the Link Podcast, your link to the legislature. For more information on healthcare policy and the U.S. Oncology Network, visit www.legislink.com.